From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. More grim unemployment numbers today. Another 4.4 million people filed for unemployment last week, bringing the total jobless claims over the past 5 weeks to more than 26 million people. Later today, the House of Representatives is expected to pass a second round of economic relief for small and medium-sized businesses to maintain payrolls during the crisis. Joining us now is NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales. Claudia, before we get to this package, we're getting word of how coronavirus is affecting members of Congress. Elizabeth Warren has said that her older brother died of COVID-19, and now more news from Congresswoman Maxine Waters today.
Right. That was an earth-shattering moment on the House floor where Maxine Waters addressed the condition of her sister who has coronavirus, and it sounds like it's very serious. So it just shows how personally touched these lawmakers are during this pandemic.
Well, and today they're on the House floor because the House is trying to pass more money for small and medium-sized business. Who is going to get money under this nearly $500 billion bill? There's been so much controversy about big businesses getting money from the last round.
Yeah, so the focus of this bill was to supplement an earlier coronavirus relief bill that was passed last month. This was a $2 trillion bill. They had a small business loan program, turned out to be very popular, so popular they ran out of money within a matter of days. And now they're going to replenish that with about $300 billion. The hope is this time they will be able to direct that money towards actual small businesses. We're not going to hear about these major hotels or major food retailers getting the money. Mm-hmm. And they've installed some provisions in the bill that they say they hope to see that money more directed to these smaller businesses this time around.
And House Democrats are proposing a special oversight committee to keep track of all this money. But here's what Arizona Republican Congresswoman Debbie Lesko said about that idea.
Since the beginning of 2019, I've served on three committees, including Judiciary Committee. And in every single committee, the entire goal has been nonstop to criticize President Trump and try to influence the 2020 election.
So given that opposition, what kind of oversight is there going to be, Claudia?
So there are multiple layers of oversight. In the previous bills, they've included efforts for inspector generals to oversee how this money is spent, a special panel of appointees made by lawmakers to oversee how this money is spent. That's still coming together. And then today, there's been debate about creating yet another committee to oversee what these funds, what will happen with these funds and how they are spent. So there's several layers. Also, there's the standing committees for Congress, such as oversight committees, that will also have a hand in looking into how this money is spent.
Now, as lawmakers gather for this vote, how does that work? Are they socially distanced from each other?
Yeah, so this is a very different look than when they gathered more than a month ago, March 14th, they did a voice vote, and they did socially distance. This time around, they're doing a roll call vote. So they're breaking down all the lawmakers into alphabetical order into different groups, nine groups for each vote. There's two votes today, and they'll be able to vote over a 10-minute period or what have you. But basically, it's turned this day into an all-day affair to get these two votes through, whereas maybe previously they could have done it in a couple of hours. People are wearing masks. You're seeing all sorts of changes so people can social distance in a new way on that floor.
NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as the number of jobless Americans continues to rise, President Trump has been pushing for the U.S. to reopen. He's even tweeted out the Liberate slogan, echoing rhetoric of protesters who want to restart state economies. But yesterday, he said Georgia Governor Brian Kemp had taken reopening a step too far in his decision to allow Georgia businesses like hair salons and bowling alleys to begin operating again under social distancing rules.
I told the governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, that I disagree strongly with his decision to open certain facilities which are in violation of the phase one guidelines.
We're joined now by Stephen Fowler, reporter at Georgia Public Broadcasting. And Stephen, Georgia is supposed to start reopening tomorrow and Monday. We've been hearing pushback from mayors for weeks. Now the president himself. Any chance that this will affect Kemp's decision making?
Well, you know, Tanya, it's been a bit of a whiplash here in Georgia over the last couple of days. You know, the president unveiled his guidelines for some states to reopen, pushing for states to reopen early. Governor Brian Kemp made this announcement that he was following those guidelines and having some businesses return to a semblance of normal operations. And now you have the president backing out on that and saying that Governor Kemp's decision was too much too soon and that he didn't recommend it. Now, President Trump also did say that it is up to Governor Brian Kemp, and that's a message that the governor is taking to heart. He has no indication that he is going to back out of this decision, says that he's going to keep going it, even as the president really threw him under the bus at the briefing yesterday.
So Governor Kemp has said that this decision is driven by data and public health officials at the state level. Meanwhile, the top federal public health official managing this crisis, Dr. Anthony Fauci, has warned Kemp to be careful. What does your reporting say about the data and whether Georgia really is ready to reopen?
Well, so the Georgia Department of Public Health has been putting out daily updates at noon and 7 p.m. each day. And they've been adding cases. Now, the raw number of cases continues to go up, but the Department of Public Health goes back and codes that for the respective day that somebody was diagnosed with a case or that somebody died. So their reporting says that the number of cases in Georgia has gone down for about 7 days. Now, the White House says it should be 14 days before things open up. Yeah. So even with the state's data, Georgia is not ready to reopen. But Governor Kemp says that it's an incremental step that he's taking, that these businesses are going from completely closed to what's known as minimum basic operations, which is about 24 different health and safety and social distancing policies. This doesn't mean that everyone's going to be able to go get a haircut starting tomorrow, but it does mean that these businesses can start to get back to normal.
That's Georgia Public Broadcasting reporter Stephen Fowler. Thank you so much. Well, we've been checking in on coronavirus cases around the world. Right now, we want to go to Turkey, where the number of confirmed cases is nearing 100,000 and the death toll is over 2,000. Turkey's health minister says the pandemic is under control, but critics have their doubts. NPR's Peter Kenyon joins us from Istanbul. And Peter, what is life like there right now?
Well, it is a beautiful spring day. The weather's gorgeous and everybody's stuck inside is basically the story. The city is so quiet, you're hearing birds that you never knew existed before. There's a pod of dolphins out in the Bosporus. I saw them this morning. They were easy to spot by the cloud of gulls hovering over them. And people say their return is because of the lack of noisy ship engines moving through the strait. It's just much quieter. A few tankers here and there, but nothing like the usual marine traffic. The roads are also quiet. So basically, Istanbul is quite a peaceful place.
We've been hearing about those large number of cases there. What is Turkey doing to combat and contain the coronavirus and COVID-19?
Well, Turkey imposed a curfew on the bulk of its population for the past 2 weekends, and that has now been expanded to 4 days. There's a 6-foot social distancing rule, and the Interior Ministry says more than 3,000 people have been cited for violating that. Schools are closed, large gatherings canceled, non-essential businesses are shut. Now, there's a key period coming up, the holy month of Ramadan. The health minister says it's crucial that this not be seen as an excuse to relax the social distancing or other measures. It's often a time for large family gatherings, not this year.
Are folks feeling confidence in the government and in the actions that they're taking that you mentioned?
Well, there are critics who argue Turkey's still trying too hard to keep the economy going, and the absence of a full 24/7 lockdown could be putting lives at risk. The high tally of new cases is worrying to many, but on the other hand, the death rate in Turkey remains relatively low, less than half the rate of Iran next door, for example. There is also criticism about the reliability of the official figures, and a lot of that is due to testing. Some 750,000 tests have been carried out so far. But, you know, in a country with 81 million people, that can still come in for criticism.
I want to ask you about something else. So elsewhere, there are concerns that the ruling parties may be using this pandemic to consolidate power and weaken their rivals. We talked about this, actually, in regards to Poland yesterday. Is that an issue in Turkey?
It's certainly a big concern among the opposition parties here. They are arguing that President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his ruling party have basically spent a decade and a half accumulating and expanding their political power at the expense of the opposition. In a recent speech in response, Erdogan accuses the opposition of putting on what he calls a political show instead of helping to fight the pandemic. Now, obviously, as the virus spreads, more and more people are turning to the government for help. So the question may arise of some kind of public judgment of how well the government responds to this crisis. That really probably won't be clear until 2023, when the next presidential elections are due to be held.
That's NPR's Peter Kenyon speaking with us from Istanbul. Peter, as always, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tanya.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
The coronavirus pandemic has forced most of us into social isolation. But for veterans with mental health issues, staying at home runs counter to the advice doctors have been giving them to get out and interact with the world. Jennifer Brooklyn from member station WUNC reports.
Veterans with PTSD have a range of treatment options, including medication and therapy. But mental health professionals also encourage coping behaviors, like getting out into nature, being physically active, and spending time with positive people. Marine Corps veteran Ryan Domecq Hernandez says he struggles with mental health issues, including PTSD and substance abuse. But he recently joined a group called Irreverent Warriors that brings veterans together for hikes and hangouts.
They get us out of ourselves. They give us some camaraderie. They give us that unit feeling of brotherhood that we've been missing. So I have a band of brothers now. If something were to happen, I can call on 40 people and say, hey, man, I'm going through this. What can we do? Well, let's get up and let's go get coffee.
But things are different now. They can't meet up for coffee or for family picnics or happy hours. And their signature hikes, well, they can get massive with up to 300 people packed together on the trails. So they're on hold for now, too. Domecq Hernandez says he's worried about the toll that social distancing will take on him and his new friends.
I think we definitely need human interaction in our lives. And being how we are right now in the state that we are right now, I think a lot of people, you're going to find a lot of people's mental health is going to come out, definitely. There's going to be a lot of people depressed. There's going to be a lot of people that need that social interaction in their life. And without them having that, it's going to go back to being alone, feeling alone. And that's not really a good place to be.
Hike leader Jeremy Walton says the longer group members have to keep their distance, the more veterans who relied on in-person social interaction could backslide.
All I can say is that this thing has put a big hole in a lot of our chests, because we use this time to get together as a way to heal, and that takes us a step back, being forced to not do anything.
David Benedek, chair of psychiatry at the Department of Defense's Medical School in Bethesda, Maryland, confirms that loneliness can indeed exacerbate some mental health conditions. He says some veterans are at especially high risk for a regression. Older veterans and those who were already isolated, those with functional limitations, and vets who experienced trauma.
There's a study that showed that loneliness contributes to the development of depression, which continued towards a downward spiral.
But he says being socially distant doesn't have to mean feeling lonely. Terry Tenelian, a behavioral scientist and an expert on military and veteran health with the RAND Corporation, agrees. She says there's mounting evidence to suggest that using technology to replace in-person interaction can be just as effective.
I've seen some, new research that shows that online and virtual structured support engagements, through online communities are also showing positive impacts in helping people feel more connected. So I think the evidence is growing, and it is showing that those virtual opportunities can be just as impactful and important.
For members of the Irreverent Warriors, though, a virtual hike just couldn't deliver what the real thing does. They need the proximity to feel the camaraderie. So Walton says although they've canceled activities through mid-May, they're thinking of other ways to get together still, in person.
If you really want to get out of the house, we'll have a barbecue, we'll shoot guns out back, we'll literally stagger you every 15 minutes, we'll give you a fresh pair of clothes, or you bring a fresh pair of clothes, and we will hang out.
These veterans don't want to take chances with their health. They say they'll be smart about their contact. But Walton says for them, getting together isn't a choice. It would be too unhealthy not to. For Here and Now, I'm Jennifer Brookland.
If you've been having strange dreams lately and trouble sleeping, you're not alone. The stress caused by coronavirus and being holed up at home are probably to blame. Joining us now to talk about that is Matthew Walker, professor of neuroscience at UC Berkeley and author of the book Why We Sleep. Matthew, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
Well, let's start with dreams. Why is this time that we are all in affecting our dreams so much? People are reporting really crazy, weird, vivid dreams.
Firstly, I think what's happening is that people are starting to shift their sleep schedule. So they're starting to sleep a little bit later. If they don't have to commute or get the kids to school, it gives them a change in their schedule. And what we know is that your dream sleep is not evenly distributed across the night. The later into the morning that we sleep, the more REM sleep, which is dream sleep, we actually have. So firstly, I think that that shift may actually explain why people are overall experiencing more dreaming. That may be why we're dreaming more, but why are we having these specific sort of pandemic dreams? Well, we know that dream sleep or rapid eye movement sleep or REM sleep essentially provides the brain a form of overnight therapy, that dreaming helps process difficult emotional experiences. And we can think of that dream sleep like a nocturnal soothing balm that takes the sharp edges off the emotional concerns and experiences that we're having whilst we're awake. So I think dreaming may actually be a response to try and help us process this emotional difficulty that we're all going through.
Now, dreaming assumes that you're able to actually sleep and sleep through the night. And a lot of people are having problems doing that right now. I can say from personal experience, I've been going to bed around a normal time, but then I end up waking up at 1 or 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning for a good half an hour before I could go back to bed.
Yeah, this is something else that we know is very common, that anxiety is a trigger of bad sleep. In fact, I think it was the British writer Charlotte Bronte, she had a lovely phrase. She said that a ruffled mind makes for a restless pillow. We know that people who have high levels of anxiety or stress during the day have a higher likelihood of having difficulty either falling asleep or staying asleep. And when you wake up in the middle of the night, typically we have this sort of Rolodex of anxiety that starts to flood back into our mind and we start to ruminate or catastrophize. Unfortunately, we know that it's a two-way street as well, that if you're not getting sufficient sleep or good quality sleep, you're more likely to feel anxious the next day, and it develops this vicious cycle. Why is it that anxiety prevents us from sleeping or makes it more difficult? There's probably a number of reasons, but chief among them is that when we are anxious, we shift over more towards the fight or flight branch of the nervous system. And normally it's that type of nervous system activity that quiets down as we're getting ready to go to sleep and we go into sleep. But if that activity of the nervous system is too high, then we're not going to be able to fall asleep easily and certainly not stay asleep well.
Well, and I'm sure that I'm making the wrong decision every time when I'm awake in the middle of the night. I pick up my phone and start reading the news, which is probably the source of my anxiety in the first place.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, it's one of those things that we can consider. What's under your control right now? And how could you perhaps stay away from things that are going to prevent you from sleeping well? And could it be that one tries to limit themselves to morning and late afternoon checking of what's going on with the COVID virus if people feel as though it's triggering them and making them not sleep as soundly at night? Certainly when you wake up in the middle of the night, the advice is don't stay in bed. You should normally get out of bed after about 20 or 25 minutes. Go and do something else in dim light, just read a book. Don't check your phone. and then only return to bed when you are sleepy. So, for example, you would never sit at the dinner table waiting to get hungry. So why would you lie in bed waiting to get sleepy?
Why do we remember some of our dreams and not others? And in this case in particular, I feel like there have been a number of dreams that I and many others can remember very vividly in the morning.
There are probably at least two reasons that increase the likelihood that someone will remember their dreams. The first is that during that dream process itself, if you wake up, and many of us will wake up at the end of these REM sleep dream periods, if you wake up for a little bit of time and then go back to sleep, that seems to increase the likelihood that in the morning or during the day, you will have recollection of that dream itself. The other is how vivid was it and how emotional was it? The higher those two things are, typically, the more likely it is that you're going to remember them.
How are your sleep and dreams going now?
Well, I am trying to stick to a set of things that normally I describe to a lot of people for better sleep. And for the most part, I'm okay. I'm not some poster child for great sleep. I've had my struggles with insomnia in my past. Just because I know about sleep doesn't mean I always get good sleep. But I am trying as best I can right now. Firstly, the key thing is regularity. Try to go to bed at the same time and wake up at the same time. It doesn't have to be the typical time that you would use to go to work. You can play and find your natural rhythm, but once you have it, stick to it. The second is try to avoid having a nightcap in the evening. Many people turn to alcohol as a sleep aid. Unfortunately, it's a sedative and sedation is not sleep. Alcohol will actually make you wake up throughout the night and it will also block that dream sleep that's so critical for mental health. And then the final two things I typically try to do. The first is that I remove all clock faces from my bedroom and I don't check the phone. It's in a different room. Because even if you are struggling with sleep, knowing that it's 3:25 a.m. or 4:45 a.m. in the morning, it's not going to help you at that moment. It's only going to make matters worse. The final thing I try to do is usually take a hot bath before bed. It's not just because it relaxes you, but when you get out of the bath, your core body temperature plummets. And in fact, we know that you need to drop your body temperature to fall asleep and get good deep sleep.
Hmm. Very good advice. Matthew Walker, a professor of neuroscience at UC Berkeley and author of the book, Why We Sleep. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much. Sleep well.
Another 4.4 million U.S. workers filed for unemployment benefits last week, bringing the total to 26 million. But Europe isn't seeing anywhere near as many job losses, even though its economy has also collapsed. NPR's Jim Zaroli explains.
On April 8th, Rita Mayer found out he was getting furloughed from his job at a video streaming service in London.
There's no work in my specific industry right now anyway. Everything's on hold.
But when I talked to him a few days later, Mayer sounded remarkably blasé about not working.
I woke up a couple hours later than I normally would. I won't lie. I've got a remote personal training, like fitness session, in about 20 minutes.
Mayer can rest easy because Britain handles unemployment much differently than the United States. Economist Gabriel Zuckman of UC Berkeley says in the U.S., when the economy turns sour, workers often get fired. They get unemployment benefits, but they have to look for a new job. And Zuckman says the experience is brutal.
Unemployment is anxiety-inducing. There's no guarantee that they will find their job back when the crisis is over.
When a crisis hits in much of Europe, workers stay on the payroll. The government pays much of their salaries, though the systems vary from country to country. Zuckman says this way is more humane and much less disruptive for businesses. Alexander Kranke runs a software company near Dusseldorf. His business has fallen off a cliff, but the German government is paying many of his 130 workers to stay home. When the economy recovers, he can simply call them back to work.
It basically means we will survive and we will be able to keep the workforce on board. So that's a pretty powerful tool, actually, for us.
In the United States, Congress did recently adopt a version of this system called the Paycheck Protection Program. Small companies get loans, but the debt is forgiven if they don't lay anyone off. Conservative Republican Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri has proposed a much broader program. Companies, all kinds of companies, would get money to keep their workers on staff. He says this is an emergency and people's livelihoods are on the line. He spoke on KMOX radio.
Wouldn't it be better to keep people's jobs, give them that security, and get ready to work again when we open this economy back up?
Hawley says yes, such a program would be expensive, but the government's already putting out piles of money anyway through unemployment insurance. There are skeptics, among them Jason Furman, former Obama economic advisor. Furman says programs like these end up throwing money at companies that don't need it. They probably would survive the pandemic anyway.
I think a lot of it is a windfall to their owners.
Furman says if the current downturn lasts, a lot of businesses are going to fail, and not even rich companies like Germany can prop them up forever. Handing them money simply pushes back the day of reckoning for them.
If a couple months from now, the business can't come back, it doesn't have enough demand, it doesn't have people coming in, as soon as the subsidies end, they're going to fire those workers.
But Furman says if the downturn lasts just a couple of months and the economic damage is limited, the European model probably makes some sense. If nothing else, it would freeze the job market in place until companies get a little more clarity about what lies ahead. And it would do so with a lot less pain for their workers. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
By now, most of us have been impacted by COVID-19 in some way. We know someone who has it, had it, or died from it. Like many of you, I dread that each day will bring news of another person I know who is sick or has passed away. My hometown of Detroit is a hotspot where more than 8,000 confirmed cases have been totaled and more than 740 deaths reported in the city. It's an overwhelming process for us to imagine so much loss. I am joined now by Candace Fortman, a fellow Detroiter and chief of engagement and operations at Outlier Media, who, like me, is just trying to make sense of it all. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Candace, one thing about Detroit, it's a major city, but it feels like a town. It's a place where there's truly 6 degrees of separation. I feel it all the way here in California, and I bet you can really feel it now more than ever during this pandemic.
Absolutely. I always say that Detroit is like living in a small southern town in so many ways. You can thank the legacy of GM and Ford bringing so many people here from the south. And in that way, our communities are so interconnected. And while it is a massive city in actual spacing, everyone knows everybody somehow through church, through schools, through social clubs, through working at the plant together. We become a family in a very real sense. And so we're right now watching our family suffer, and that is the entire city right now.
Yeah. I'm hearing about longtime elders of my childhood church who have passed, childhood neighbors, old friends are now sick. It's actually a lot for me to process, especially being so far away from home. And you're in the thick of it all. How are you coping?
I am very fortunate, I think, in one way that I feel really grateful to be able to do work that actually helps to inform people and as much as we can right now help to keep them safe. So I find a lot of solace in being able to do that. You know, reaching out to friends daily is helpful, but I'll be really transparent when I tell you that at some point every day, I don't know how I'm going to cope in that second. Every day has brought news about someone that I know or someone that I don't know, but feels like we're losing fabric and pieces of our city. Threads are being torn apart from us. And each one of those deaths, every time I watch that number tick up every day, feels personal. And it's, I'll tell you some days, some moments harder than others. But I'm so sorry. I know I talk to my friends all the time that are not here. And I know that being here is hard, but not being here is harder. Because you have family here, you have friends here, and even though we can't touch each other, there is something I'll tell you about looking out and seeing my neighbors' houses, being able to drive down 96, being able to drive down Schoolcraft, to be able to look in on people, just see their houses. That comforts me. And so I send you so much love because I know that that is difficult.
I saw your post about the death of Skylar Herbert. She was 5 years old, the first Michigan child to pass away from COVID-19.
Yeah. Skylar happens to be the friend of my niece. And yesterday, her dad, my niece's dad, sent me a ton of pictures of the two of them together. And I knew that I would be talking to you today, and so I asked him to share with me what he loved about Skylar. And he said she was the kind of little girl that when she saw you, she would run up to you so fast and so hard, she would almost knock you over because she didn't know any strangers. She loved everybody. And that her joy was contagious. And the idea that he would have to, at some point, explain to his daughter that her friend was gone was heartbreaking. They had been exchanging voice messages. Their parents, of course, were doing it while Skylar was in the hospital. Mm. And those messages are going to not come. And Skylar is difficult, but so are the many elders that we are losing. You know, elders hold for you the wisdom and the spirit and the soul of your city, and we are losing them every single day. And that means that when we come on the other side of this, we're going to be different.
You know, you mentioned the fabric of the city is being torn apart, and it made me think about when I first moved away from home for college. I had a friend who would joke with me that every other word from me was Detroit. And I would always joke and say, it's the spirit of Detroit in me. And so when we've been talking about Detroit making a comeback for decades now, truly in the last 5 years after the city filed for bankruptcy, we were actually seeing that comeback. We were actually seeing it in the city rebuilding. And a significant number of those who have died were part of that rebuilding. And it just shows the viciousness of this virus. But can you talk about the impact on this city? Do you feel like it's a setback?
It is certainly a financial setback. But because people matter more than money, the loss of human beings, the loss of creativity, of creative minds, of business minds, of people who thought deeply about equity and how we could not just be a city that's on the comeback for some, but a city that is a comeback city for all, how we could be a new model for how you grow a city with all of your residents at the forefront. A lot of the folks who were instrumental in that thinking, I think of someone like Marlo Stoudemire.
And tell us who Marlo is.
Marlo was, I think, like a quintessential Detroit character to me. He was the kind of person that people called in when they wanted to connect in a real way to Detroiters. He was a consultant for many organizations, including the NHL. And he talked about diversity and engagement in a way that was authentic to Detroiters. And he knew almost everybody, and almost everybody knew him. And he spent his time and talents helping this city be a better place, and not just for the folks with the most money, but for folks that, like the people he grew up with, like the people I grew up with, that are often ignored when we talk about how do you develop and grow a city. Mm. He lost his battle with COVID very early in what feels like a lifetime now in this month and a half shutdown. When you look at the amount of people who have honored him across the world, right? You can see his impact. It was bigger than Detroit. He brought Detroit everywhere he went, and I think that's the best part about Detroiters, right? Mm-hmm. No matter where we go, mm-hmm. Detroit is with us, and we bring it with us because we're proud of this place that yeah. so many people find no value in, we know is more valuable than gold.
Mm. Is that what's going to be what keeps us moving, what keeps Detroit moving and keeps Detroiters going? I mean, what's your message really to fellow Detroiters who are also mourning right now?
So the other day, my friends and I, like many friends across the country, were watching the Babyface and Teddy Riley battle on Instagram. And in the middle, I was watching it on Zoom with a bunch of friends here in the city. And we, of course, were not together, but there we all were. And at some point, somebody started ballroom dancing, which for those of you who don't know, ballroom hustling in this yep. city is almost a religion. mm-hmm. It happens a lot. And to see that, like this moment, like no matter what is happening, we're our culture is here. We're still together, right? We are in our separate homes, but I feel them. I feel their sadness. I feel their losses. I also feel their hope and their joy for the future. We might not be able to hug. We might not be able to stand next to each other. But like we always have in this city, we are in this together. Nothing stops Detroit. When we say that, we mean it.
That's Candace Fortman, Detroiter and Chief of Engagement and Operations at Outlier Media. Candace, I'm sending you a big hug. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really do appreciate it.
When can I see you again? When can my heart beat again? When can I see you again? And when can I breathe once again? And when can I see you? When does my summer?
The World Health Organization said this week that it's likely the new coronavirus originated in animals, not in a lab. That announcement came after President Trump was asked last week about a theory that scientists dispute that the virus was accidentally released from a lab in Wuhan.
In the investigation into whether the virus escaped from this lab in Wuhan, how active is that? And when
we're looking at it. A lot of people are looking at it. It seems to make sense. They talk about a certain kind of bat, but that bat wasn't in that area.
U.S. intelligence agencies have also said the virus most likely spread naturally and was not from a lab. Adam Taylor of The Washington Post joins us now. Adam, let's talk first about this theory of this lab in Wuhan. It does research coronaviruses. Why do scientists, though, say it is unlikely the virus originated there?
So the reason this lab has sort of become the focus of attention is that there was research being done there on bat coronaviruses. Bats are kind of a reservoir of coronaviruses. There's all sorts of different viruses in them. So researchers want to look at them and see what they can find out about these viruses. What has sort of emerged gradually and kind of changed a bit over the past few months, you had in January people were talking about this lab, and the fringe theory was that it was some sort of bioweapon, man-made or man-altered. That has since emerged to be clearly very unlikely, just from looking at the virus's genome. But what people are saying now is that perhaps this could have been somehow leaked during, non-bioweapon research, just sort of regular, legitimate research from the Wuhan Institute of Virology. You know, I've spoken to a lot of virologists and biochemists, and I think everyone agrees it's a vague possibility, the idea that it could have leaked. But the far more likely possibility is that it came from bats, probably went through an intermediate animal, and then infected humans. So there's not really that any evidence to disagree with that at this point.
But there are still a lot of people who believe that this virus came out of a lab. You write that a recent Pew poll showed that almost 3 in 10 Americans believe the virus could have been made in a lab. Republicans are twice as likely to believe these theories compared with Democrats. Where are these theories circulating? Where is this coming from?
So, and like I said, it's kind of been this thing where it's kind of started sort of in fringe theories. In January, you saw maybe, I think, Daily Mail and the Washington Times published some stories about bioweapons. since that's been pretty clearly refuted, since then it's kind of evolved into this other theory. You saw Senator Tom Cotton of people talking about the idea it leaked from a lab. You don't see many scientists talking about this. This is one thing I wanted to make clear. It is mostly coming from politicians, you know, either people who are very skeptical of the Chinese government or people who are maybe a bit more conspiratorial in their way of thinking. I think in a way it's kind of natural to look for a simple sort of clean-cut answer that fits into people's sort of political biases. But at the same time, it's kind of Occam's razor. Like it's the simplest answer is actually that it came from bats with jump through humans in nature.
And in terms of scientists trying to trace that this originated in animals and it moved from animal to animal to human, how close are we to being certain that that's what happened?
My sense is that it might take a pretty long time. When the sort of virus's genome was first sort of identified and put on the internet, ironically, the lab at the center of all the conspiracy theories, Wuhan Institute of Virology, you know, they looked through their archives of different coronaviruses and they said, this is 96% similar to a coronavirus we found in a horseshoe bat in a cave in Yunnan. This has actually ended up adding to conspiracies, as you know, I think Trump and other people have noticed. Yunnan is not very close to Hubei. You know, the idea that it could have been taken there as part of some research project, that has spread quite widely. But 4% difference is quite substantial. And most sort of virologists I've spoken to think like it's still pretty likely. There's no evidence that it wouldn't have just been spreading throughout nature. The other SARS virus, the big outbreak of 2003-2004, that was also linked to a horseshoe bat in a cave in Yunnan. They didn't find that out for more than a decade later. And this is like pretty serious research that takes a long time.
Well, is part of the issue in terms of the skepticism about where this came from that China was not originally very forthcoming about the virus? Did that create some suspicion that allowed people to take these theories as far as they have?
I would say that's probably true, particularly in January and February. You did see a lot of stuff on the Chinese internet talk about how it could have been linked to U.S. bioweapons programs. And later on, you saw actually the Chinese foreign ministry officials saying that, you know, we don't know that this virus originated in China. And that is really unsupported by science. And if the likelihood it was released from a lab is small, this is even smaller that it started somewhere else. So, I mean, I think there's definitely a lot of distrust of the Chinese government. At the same time, you know, I find it hard to view people have so much suspicion of these Chinese scientists doing research into bat coronaviruses that seems very unfair and very sort of aggressive. I do think it's natural to an extent to look to someone to blame. It's just not necessarily helpful.
That is Adam Taylor, who's a reporter with The Washington Post. Adam, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.